to a special edition of Midday. I'm Gary Eichten, and this hour we're on the road in the northern suburbs, broadcasting live from the Majestic Oaks Country Club in Ham Lake, where the Metro North Chamber of Commerce is sponsoring the second debate of the fall campaign between the major candidates for the U.S. Senate, Republican incumbent Rod Grams, Democrat Mark Dayton, and independent, James Gibson. Members of the Metro North Chamber are here. We have students from the Anoka-Hennepin School District joining us. It really should be a great opportunity to hear the candidates discuss the issues and respond to questions from our audience. Now, before we get started, a word about the Metro North Chamber. These kinds of events are pretty much old hat for them. They've been sponsoring public forums with top policymakers, business leaders, even international figures for the past 15 years. And we'd like to thank them for allowing us to broadcast today's debate and allowing us to moderate it. Format is really pretty simple. We'll suggest some subjects for the candidates to discuss. We've encouraged them to talk freely among themselves about those subjects. I'll try to do a play-by-play for those of you listening on the radio so you have some idea of who's actually saying what. Those of you here in the audience, as you know, we've passed out cards. Jot your questions down on the cards that have been provided, and we'll try to add as many of those to the mix as possible. The debate will run until 1 o'clock today. The candidates will have 2 minutes at the end to make a closing statement. But to begin, we thought the best way to do this would give each of the candidates about 2 minutes to explain why they are the best person to represent Minnesota in the U.S. Senate for the next 6 years. Now, in our flawless planning, we were going to do this in alphabetical order. But Mark Dayton, Democrat Mark Dayton, has not been able to get here yet from the debate these gentlemen just finished. He'll be here shortly, so let's start with James Gibson. Mr. Gibson, a couple of minutes on why you're the best candidate.
Well, first of all, I want to touch upon the theme of my campaign, and that'll give you an idea about how I think and why I think I would best represent this state. My campaign is about what I call intergenerational justice, and I will talk about issues always in that context. The issue that really got me into the race and the issue which, but it simply exemplifies the kind of issue that concerns me, was the big push for an income tax cut as soon as we saw projections of a budget surplus. I felt very strongly that we had much more to gain from using the surplus to pay down the national debt. So I'm the one candidate in this race that is neither pushing for a tax cut nor pushing for expanded federal spending. Secondly, we need to move our Social Security system from a pay-as-you-go system to one that has real assets, because what we have is a system that doesn't work when the demographics change. When they change, it produces significant injustices from one generation to the next. Thirdly, education. We need to make sure that we educate our kids for an increasingly integrated and interdependent global economy. It's a much tougher world, and we have to acknowledge that. Our kids have to be able to compete internationally. It's not enough that they show well against kids from other states. And fourth, environmentally, we simply need to leave the world a better place than we found it. That doesn't mean we need to solve all of our problems overnight, but it simply means we need to make steady progress. These are all intergenerational issues. I push very strongly for a last issue, and that's the need for campaign finance reform.
That was Independent Party candidate James Gibson. And next up, incumbent Republican Senator Rod Grams. Sir Grams?
Thank you very much, Gary, and thank you all for being here. And I want to thank the North Metro Chamber of Commerce for also giving us this opportunity to talk today about the issue and address the concerns of that are very important to our job creators, to our families, to our senior citizens, veterans, teachers, and students, and of course, most especially, to the people that I can usually call the most used and abused people in the United States today, and that is the taxpayer. Now, I learned my values growing up on my farm, my family's farm in Isani County, just back door from here, and I see a lot of my friends and neighbors that are here today at lunch. I don't want to call them old friends, but just all friends. And but these values, I think, have helped guide me ever since. And with every piece of legislation that I write, with every vote that I take, and every promise that I make as your senator, I've remained true to the foundation of hard work, respect, responsibility, individual opportunity, and also all those things that define us as Minnesotans. And I want to continue working on your behalf in Congress. But this election is not about me. It isn't about Mark Dayton. It isn't about Jim Gibson. It's about you and who is best able to represent your values and your dreams in Washington. If you want a voice for bigger government, more rules, more regulations, more Washington intrusion, well, then you'll vote for Mark Dayton. If you want more freedom for your family, your business, that comes from lower taxes, less government intervention, and fewer roadblocks to success, you'll vote for me. If you're content to continue pouring your hard-earned dollars into Social Security that offers meager benefits at best, and no guarantee of benefits, by the way, in another 30 years, well, then you'll vote for Mark Dayton, who wants to continue that program. But if you want to save Social Security for today's retirees and also the dream of wealth and security and retirement for our children and grandchildren to protect and maintain a sound retirement system in this country, you'll vote for me. And if you're content with schools where Washington has more influence than parents and teachers and local school boards, a Washington-run healthcare system where bureaucrats stand beside and between you and your doctors, or a military where our soldiers depend on food stamps today and substandard housing, you'll vote for Mark Dayton. But if you have a dream of a better way, you'll vote for me. So I'm proud of my record in Congress. I'm proud of the legislation I've passed and my work in Washington. I think it's improved the quality of life for every Minnesotan, and I hope that you'll give me the opportunity to work for you for another 6 years. Thank you.
Okay, that was Republican Rod Grams, and again, we'll be hearing from Mark Dayton here in just a moment. Mr. Dayton has just arrived. There was a debate over in Brooklyn Center this morning. The candidates have been very, very busy. They were at the Earl Brown Interpretive Center debating before the Minnesota Utility Investors Candidate Forum, and hustled over here to Ham Lake. And now Mr. Dayton has joined us. Good afternoon, Mark Dayton.
Well, I obviously didn't hustle as fast as my competitors. I apologize.
What we're doing here, I wanted to give each of the candidates 2 minutes to kind of explain why you think you're the best candidate to represent Minnesota for the next 6 years. And why don't we hear from you on that?
Again, side. I apologize for keeping you waiting. I was told that the debate was beginning at 12:20, so I thought I was arriving early. Much to my surprise, I was not. But I want to thank you all for this opportunity to be here and to talk about this election, which I believe is really about our priorities as a nation for all of our citizens. How we as a nation will capitalize on this exceptional opportunity which we have to continue our strong economic growth, which is the key to all of the proposals you'll hear today and throughout this campaign, and to the desired outcomes. How to restore our country's fiscal security by paying down and eliminating within the next 10 to 12 years the national debt, and how to expand economic and social opportunity for all of our citizens. I want us, through the private sector economy, to enable all Americans to achieve the American dream the old-fashioned way, by earning it their own financial security through jobs that pay wages so that people, by working full-time, can lift themselves and their families out of poverty and into a better life. That they can earn health security for themselves and their families in the workplace. Retirement security through their personal savings, private investment accounts, 401ks, IRAs, and a social security system that will be sound for this and future generations. I would achieve this through a balanced budget proposal, taking the $1.8 trillion in non-dedicated surplus and putting 12% of that to targeted spending increases for education, for Head Start, for health care, for housing. Twice that amount for tax reductions targeted toward working middle-income families. I would make the college tuition tax deductible for students or the parents, allow health care premiums to be deductible for employees, the self-employed farmers. I would increase the child tax credit and the child dependent care credit, and I would end the taxation of Social Security. I put the remaining 64% into debt reduction.
Okay, that was Democrat Mark Dayton. Well, let's get to some of the issues that have come up. Now, the first debate before the Minnesota Chamber here a couple of weeks ago, we started off talking about health care and spent a fair amount of time talking about that because the candidates differ significantly on that issue. Today, let's start with Social Security, another important issue that the candidates have different views on. And let's start with Senator Grams. For over 60 years, people have been able to count on getting that monthly Social Security check, maybe not a big check, but it arrived every month. Now, you're proposing a plan to privatize a major share of the system so people could invest their own money and conceivably get a much larger check than they're currently getting. But wouldn't it also essentially eliminate the safety net that people have come to rely on? Why not leave the system in place, as some have suggested, and then maybe encourage people to get more involved in 401ks and the like?
All right. Well, for, you know, if you've got a lot of money and, you know, maybe like Mark can have and pay into Social Security and then be able to have outside investments, that might be great. But for most Americans, we have a hard time just meeting our bills and paying our taxes with very little left at the end of the month to put in the savings. Now, you mentioned Social Security. For 65 years, it's done exactly what we have asked it as a nation to do, and that is to pay retirement benefits to millions of Americans. It has done that job, but if you look ahead at the next 30 years, it cannot meet those same obligations. The demographics have changed. If we were going to invent Social Security today, we would never have the same system as we have now, because it just can no longer work. So my opponent, Mr. Dayton, would say, well, we want government to remain in control, so let's put a big Band-Aid over this, and by the way, let's pump more money into the system to continue tying our retirees to meager government checks. Now, we've got a system that is failing. Why not reform it now that we have the opportunity and the ability to do it? We can do a better job. Now, my plan, Gary, it is a social safety net as well. And people say, well, this isn't just retirement. There are other benefits. That's true. And my plan, just like Social Security, would have disability insurance. It would also have survivor's benefits, so that if you were disabled or your spouse died, you would have these guaranteed benefits, just like Social Security today. But if you're allowed to invest at least a portion into investments that are very safe, now they'll say, well, you know, the stock market, it's risky, it's up and down. You know, you can invest your whole life and never buy one share of stock. There's 1,000 things you can invest in. And by the way, if you wanted to put your money just in a 3.5% passbook savings account, you'd get more than 3 times the benefit that you're going to get promised under Social Security. So we can do better, we can have safe retirement, and we can have better benefits all at one time, and not waste this opportunity to reform and improve retirement, not to keep an old failing system. Is this the type of retirement we want to pass on to our children and grandchildren? I don't think so. We can do better, and I think if we're going to be leaders and statesmen, it's time that we lead and not just duck behind this issue for another election or a campaign.
Now, James Gibson, you've supported some form of privatization. You think Senator Graham's plan is a good one?
I do support privatization, but for different reasons than the senator. I think some of the reasons the senator advances are disingenuous. For example, you cannot compare the return you'll get in a private system versus the system we have today without acknowledging that we have to deal with this unfunded liability. We have a $9 trillion unfunded liability that has to be dealt with whether we privatize or not. And you need to factor into that into the kinds of returns that a privatized system would have unless you have another source of revenue. I've taken the position that we should take this $9 trillion unfunded liability and literally transfer it to the U.S. government, book it as real debt, because then we'll begin to treat it as real debt. We'll acknowledge it and begin discharging it through normal tax revenues. That would be much fairer rather than discharging this unfunded liability on the backs of workers' wages. What you have is a system today that is both unjust from an intergenerational standpoint, unjust from a social standpoint. We take money from people working at minimum wage and we transfer it to money without regard to how much, to what their income levels are. And it's all because of this unfunded nature. We never book the liability. So I advocate booking the liability. You now have a system on the Social Security side which is actuarially sound. You can then set up individual accounts. Everybody is freed of this unfunded liability and can go forward. And I do have to take exceptions with something you said, Mark. When you talk about paying the debt down in 12 years, what we're talking about, and you'll hear President Clinton talking about this and Trent Lott, we're talking about paying down the debt that's owed to the public, not the debt that's owed to the trust funds. You've got to acknowledge that debt, and that this debt will not be nearly paid off by 2012. If you're going to say 2012, you'd have to say we have absolutely no assets in the Social Security system, therefore 2037 is not the date when we'll have a crisis.
Mark Dayton?
I'm accused of paying down all the Social Security, we owe $3.7 trillion domestically, $1.1 trillion to foreign countries and individuals and institutions, $4.8 trillion, and then the rest of it is owed within the system itself. So, I mean, I have taken figures that have come out of the Congressional Budget Office and other Vice President candidate Gore and the like in terms of my numbers, but I'll be glad to compare them with yours. You know, I think regarding Social Security or an alternative, we ought to start with the premise that anybody in a responsible position or seeking a responsible position wants to provide for the best possible and most secure retirement income for all of our citizens. We can have our differences, and there can be honest differences about how best to accomplish that, but I think that ought to be the basis of those debates. Unfortunately, and what makes this difficult are a couple of things. One is we're talking about a huge system in terms of dollars and recipients. We're talking about projections 10, 20, 30, 75 years down the road. And we're talking about our very limited ability to project what the economic circumstances will be. I would be very pleased, Senator, if we could agree or get some impartial third party to agree on a set of economic assumptions for the next 30 and 50 years, and then compare plans and proposals on that basis, because if yours were to come out ahead, I'd be the first to support it. But you and other proponents of privatization run your blue sky portfolio assumptions based on a consistently high rate of economic growth, real GDP of 3% or more, leading to a stock market real rate of return of 7% without factoring in any of the administrative costs nor any of the volatility that accompanies that market. Conversely, Social Security is, by the mid-range projection of the Social Security trustees, expected to run to the point where its income will not be sufficient to meet all of its obligations in the year 2037, based on an economic forecast of real GDP growth of 1.7%. In other words, a decidedly more pessimistic assumption than the privatization proponents use for the basis of theirs. If you were to assume the same rate of growth, 3% GDP over the next 37 years, at that point in time, the Social Security Trust Fund, with its present payment schedule, would have between $30 and $50 trillion in surplus in that account. Obviously, the payout could be expanded. So if we're going to make an intelligent decision, not as one candidate or another, even one party or another, if we're going to make an intelligent decision as the American people, what kind of system do we want for the retirement of our present elderly and those of us who will soon follow, we ought to have it on, based on an accurate comparison of the facts.
Okay. And if we could kind of keep things moving along here. Senator Grahams?
Gary, just in response to Mark when he says use a set of numbers, well, the numbers I've used in my plan are those offered by the Social Security Administration trustees themselves and the CBO. And the numbers I've used for the on the investment side is 75 years of records of investment in this country that have produced more than 7% real return after you wring out inflation and other things. My plan is also figured in the cost of administering this program and providing the insurance for disability and survivors' benefits as well. This has all been taken into account, Mark. These are not blue sky projections at all. We've tried to be very realistic. And by the way, the 7% return that we've used is very conservative. When you look at Chile, who had the wherewithal to go into a private retirement account 20 years ago, has enjoyed a return of better than 11.3%. Britain, which is now has a two-tier system itself, has enjoyed better than a 10% return over the last 10 years. So we are behind the curve when it comes to securing our future and our retirement plan. If we want to continue and embrace a system designed in 1935 that does not meet the needs of the year 2000 or 2035. And by the way, Mark, after the year 2015, you know we're going to have to raise taxes to retire these IOUs. So this system is not solvent until 2037. And the trustees tell us the debt is not only 9.6, but 21.6 trillion over the next 70 years. The system continues to get worse. If we refuse to look at least options, I think we're going to do the next generation a huge disservice. For those who have money and can invest outside, that's fine. But for those that their only investment for retirement is Social Security, we can't shut them out of those opportunities.
Mark Dayton?
Rod, I'm in this campaign for the same reason you, which is to do the best service, not on my own account, but for the people of Minnesota. I would just say that...
But you would not allow investments.
Again, I would take your set of assumptions and apply those to Social Security, because you're applying the more optimistic growth scenario of the trustees to your prediction and a more conservative one about half that rate of growth to Social Security. You're the one who says in your own Graham's victory line that it's a Ponzi scheme, that it's going to be soon to go bankrupt. Even the trustees admit that it will soon crumble. That's not true. That's scare tactics. That's assuming an economic collapse of this country. You can't have it both ways. If you want to take your system and say no one's going to come out behind, everybody's going to gain, the $13.5 trillion that you yourself say will be the transition cost from one system to another can easily be afforded, then you've got to assume a set of economic assumptions that are extremely optimistic, hopefully will be realized, but then you also got to apply those to the alternative and see where, again, where will the people of Minnesota and America come out most ahead. That's the discussion we should be having.
James Gibson.
I find fault with both positions. I still don't think, Senator, that you have outlined how you're going to handle the transition costs.
I have. And you've got to read my plan.
Well, I have,
because you haven't read it.
One of the ways you propose to deal with the transition costs is simply to slash non-discretionary spending by 5%. Well,
no,
this is a non-starter.
I've never.
And you continue to compare privatized versus the existing system, as Mark indicated, mm-hmm. with both a different set of assumptions and not acknowledging this unfunded liability. And Mark, I want to reiterate, when you say the debt is going to be paid off by 2012, you need to say the debt held by the public, because there's the $5.7 trillion debt today, and the debt held by the public is significantly less, about $3.7 trillion. There's a huge difference, and that spread is growing as we continue to place more assets in the Social Security Trust Fund. To say the debt is going to be paid off by 2012 and to say Social Security is solid through 2037 is deceptive.
Well, I stand corrected. I'll refer to the public debt from now on. But, yeah. Senator, I guess I'd like to go back, because you just said that, corrected to Mr. Gibson, saying that your plan does not call for a 5% cut in all discretionary spending, education, health care, even defense, and then freezing it at that level for the next 10 years, which by the end of those 10 years would be a 25% cut from the way it is today. You could call for selling $268 billion of federal assets in the first 4 months, instructing the President of the United States to do so in order to stop what I assume you believe will be the hemorrhaging of the fund as people withdraw their FICA taxes. So I don't see how you can describe it differently here from the way you put it in your own law and your own stated proposal.
I don't try to change it. I said, and I've laid out a plan where Congress can consider ways of making up these differences and shortfalls, and we can do this. Some of it might be paying down or getting rid of some of our assets. Now, in time, if Social Security is our number one concern and one of the biggest crises facing this country, we're going to have to take some drastic actions to do it. This is not going to be blue sky. It's not going to be easy. The costs are out there. Our names as a society are on the mortgage. And somehow we have to make this transition. And it's going to cost some money. Now, the question is, how do we do it with the least amount of pain to not just this generation, but the next generations? And we have spread this financing out. So when you say, I have proposed this, we have laid out in numbers that Congress could consider as a way of making the transition, so people can't say that we can't do it. We can do it.
Senator,
it's going to take some tough decisions.
You need to read your own bill, Senator.
All right.
So, let me just finish.
Very briefly, then I want to move on to some other
Section issues. 14 of your bill, 1103, says the President shall sell within 4 months of passage $268 billion of federal assets. You said in one interview that could include the Strategic Oil Reserve. So you're having to take drastic action immediately to deal with a crisis that your own legislation creates.
Brief comment, James Gibson.
Yeah, you're pushing privatization of Social Security. You're pushing a major income tax cut. I just want to make the point that the two are not compatible.
This is Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. Today we're on the road broadcasting live from the Majestic Oaks Country Club in the northern suburb of Ham Lake, where the Metro North Chamber of Commerce is sponsoring a debate between the major candidates for the U.S. Senate, Independence Party candidate James Gibson, Democrat Mark Dayton, and Republican incumbent Rod Grams. Chamber members and students from the Anoka-Hennepin School District are here in the audience, and we'll continue our Meet the Candidates broadcast in just a moment. A couple of quick reminders, though. First of all, if you have to miss part of this debate or would simply like to hear it again, we'll be rebroadcasting this program at 9 tonight on Minnesota Public Radio, or you can listen to it at your leisure on our website, minnesotapublicradio.org. We also have lots more information about the candidates and the campaigns on our website, and coming soon, it's not up yet, so don't rush to your computer yet, but coming soon we will have our computer matching service available where you can plug in your issues, your stand on the issues, and then the computer tells you which candidate most closely resembles your views on the issues, kind of like the computer dating service. That's a lot of fun and a good way to sort through some of the information. So that'll be up soon. MinnesotaPublicRadio.org. Okay, we had a suggested question here from somebody in our audience. Would you explain your gun policy or how your gun policy differs from the National Rifle Association? James Gibson, let's start with you on that one.
Well, I support the Second Amendment, but I think there's room for, and I'm not all that familiar with the detailed positions of the NRA, but I support the Second Amendment, but I think there's room for some minor adjustments that would help. The one technology that really intrigues me, by the way, is this owner recognition technology, because I think both sides of this argument could buy onto it. I do support the use of trigger locks, but I don't think it's a panacea. I think the owner recognition technology would be more of an automatic thing and far more useful. I support the 24-hour waiting period at gun shows. And I think we have to look at what's actually happening. You tend to get a picture of what's happening by isolated incidents portrayed in the media, and you see this pattern. The reality is that gun crimes are down. I saw one statistic recently where youth homicide arrests related to guns were down from 3,000 to 1,300, from 93 to 98. 3,000 to 1,300. So that's very impressive. It's important to look at that because you recognize that some of the things we are doing are paying off. Federal prosecutions are up, just as we've been talking about, and they have an effect.
Mark Dayton, how would your position differ from that of the National Rifle Association?
Well, the Second Amendment of the Constitution guarantees that people's right to bear arms shall not be infringed, and that defines the parameters of not only this debate, but any lawful policy or proposal anybody could put into place. I would differ from the NRA as I understand their position in that I would close the loopholes right now and require background checks on all purchasers of firearms, including at gun shows and other sites. I would provide for safety locks as the technology permits on handguns. And I certainly would disagree with the vote that Senator Grams took a couple of years ago in 1997, which I assume was the NRA position, where he voted one of 27 senators against an amendment that would have made it a federal law, against federal law, to possess a firearm in schools or on school property. I don't think guns have any business anywhere in our schools, near our school children, and I believe, fortunately, that law passed, despite his opposition. That would be a significant departure I would make from the NRA.
Senator Grams, how does your position differ, if at all, from the National Rifle Association's?
Well, first, let me lay out my support. I strongly support the Second Amendment, and all hunters across Minnesota know that. I also support instant background check, which the NRA does. They're probably the largest group that provides education for the ownership and handling and use of firearms in this country. Strongly support that. But I do not support keeping files on law-abiding gun owners in this country, which Mr. Dayton would, if he supports Mr. Gore and others in the Senate, their position on that. I would not require any new taxes or fees to be leveled against law-abiding gun owners in this country, as they would. And I would strongly support enforcing the laws that are currently on the books. We have something like 22,000 laws already on the books today. Let's enforce those. This administration has a terrible record of the thousands of incidents where Mark said there were maybe guns found on schoolyards. This administration has only prosecuted 8 out of those. And of all the instant background checks where there has been, where felons or others have tried to buy guns, there's only been 1 prosecution out of those thousands that have been found. So we need an administration that enforces the laws that we have today, but not to try impose new laws on really law-abiding citizens in this country when it comes to the Second Amendment.
Right. Mark, you used that before, that there are only 8 prosecutions for this federal law banning the possession of firearms on schools and school property the first year the law took into effect. There wouldn't have been any prosecutions if you had been in the majority on that vote, because you opposed that federal law.
Now, Mark, it's ridiculous that I would go out and support kids carrying guns to school.
So you voted against that amendment.
Now, there must have been something else in the bill, Mark. I don't have it in front of me, but it's ridiculous, and you know, with many bills, there's many questions asked.
No, I looked at it.
And if you want to pick that out.
That's the amendment that became the law.
And again, trying to distort a record or accuse me of doing that, I think is just poor politics.
Let's both look into it, and we'll provide the facts. So, Gary,
all right. Each of you has proposed a pretty significant, significantly different approach to dealing with the projected budget surplus. Tax cuts primarily, pay down the national debt primarily, kind of a mix that includes a fair amount of new spending. Last week, top military leaders, including the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, went to Congress and said, gee, our situation is so grim, we need a lot more money to maintain our military readiness. And somebody sat down and totaled up what the military leaders said they needed to maintain a strong military, and of course, poof, goes the surplus. Would you agree with their assessment? Do they need that much more money, Mark Dayton?
I'm not qualified to say today whether they need more money or not. If everybody's spending requests were put on the table, I'm sure the surplus would have been spent a dozen times over. But certainly the military preparedness needs to be assessed along with every other aspect. And I also think that we ought to look at whether we're have our armed forces allocated properly, given the realities of this new world order, and see if we can bring forces home. I think we need a much stronger patrolling of our immediate borders by our armed forces. I think the greatest threat to our national security today is the flood of illegal drugs coming into this country that are corrupting our kids. There are young adults on the streets, and I think that's where we ought to have a much stronger military presence and interdiction capability. I would also just point out again that if Senator Graham's proposal on Social Security were to take effect and you froze all spending, including defense spending, cut it by 5% and froze it for 10 years, you'd be 25% less in funding for defense 10 years from now than you would be if the CBO baseline projection continues to rise.
Senator Grahams, would you agree with the joint or the chairman's assessment?
And what was that assessment? They're not
basically
prepared.
They need so much more money in the future to remain prepared that there isn't fundamentally going to be a surplus.
Just a little background. This administration for 8 years has stretched this military so thin without reinvesting in it. We have soldiers, men and women, in 66 different spots around the world today. The military budget is the only budget in the government that has not had any real increase for the past 8 years. We are actually at a 35% lower spending rate than we were 8 years ago. Can we do two fronts right now, which is our strategy, to be able to fight a war or a conflict on two fronts? Well, George W. Bush, if you remember at the convention, said we were not prepared to do that. He caught a lot of criticism from that from Mr. Gore. The truth is we maybe could land the troops on two fronts and have them ready and prepared on the initial conflict or contact, but we do not have a backup. Our military has basically been decimated. We have airplanes and equipment that are older than the men and women who are using them and flying them. Do we have to put more money into it? This is the most important thing, our national security. If we cannot defend our borders or our shores, what good does it do to talk about everything else here, about Social Security and health care and everything else, if we can't protect and preserve freedom? So do we have to expand and spend more money to update our military? Yes. We have military men and women today who are serving and collecting food stamps because we do not pay them enough. And we send a lot of them out and not having the backup or the proper equipment to guarantee them the best opportunity to be successful. You saw what we were able to do in Desert Storm in 1992. We could not do that today because of the way our military has basically not been updated as it should have. So I strongly support that. Do I say we just give them carte blanche? No. But at the same time, we've got to make sure that we're spending the money adequate to protect our borders and do it in a very responsible way to the taxpayer.
James Gibson?
This is one of the issues that it would be very hard to evaluate from the outside. I certainly would want to get there and look at it very closely, not just the level of spending, but how the money is being spent. Making sure that the money is being spent is being spent for strategic reasons and not political reasons. I want to make a second point here just about budgets in general. I've taken the position that we need to have a baseline, and the baseline I've taken is our projected budget surplus that's coming from Washington, that anything we do from that point forward ought to be budget neutral. To me, unless we have that discipline, it's just a recipe for excuses for various forms of tax cuts and excuses for various forms of expanded federal spending. You know, I'm for higher level of government services. I'm also for lower taxes. But long term, we're going to meet that goal by paying down the national debt.
Rod Grimes?
I just want to make a point, too, that a lot of these assumptions are making are from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who have, in testimony and in fact reporting to the President, saying that they do not have the wherewithal as far as reserves, backup, and training and equipment to do this. So this isn't Congress or anybody else saying this is actually coming from the Pentagon and the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Was President Clinton correct in releasing part of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to deal with the apparent looming shortage or at least increase in prices, Sir Graham?
I think it was a political move. It was all for show because the amount of oil being released would not meet our energy demands in this country for a day and a half. In other words, also, if we do release these, as OPEC watches this, we are basically draining down exactly what the reserves were supposed to be, and that was in the case of a national emergency, national security, not to reduce the price of oil. By the way, the economists say it won't reduce them by 2 cents. So this is a political move to help support the election of Al Gore that says at least they're trying to do something, where basically they're doing nothing and they're putting this country more at risk. Again, we don't even have the refining capacity. We haven't built a new refinery in this country in decades, and it's because of much of this administration's philosophy of not allowing this to happen. So if this oil is moved out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve and into the pipeline, it's basically going to displace other oil that's already in the pipeline. And Al Gore even said himself in February of this year that OPEC could easily reduce their production 30 million barrels in a short period of time that would offset any gain we could do from this. So in my opinion, this was nothing but a political move, and it's going to do nothing to increase the supply that we're going to need for home heating this winter, and it's going to do nothing to reduce the price that's everybody is concerned.
James Gibson, good idea, bad idea?
Well, it certainly isn't going to influence price much. There's no question about it. I looked at this and I thought, well, heck, we can sell the oil at $38 a barrel and we'll buy it back at $25. We'll make some money on this. Why not?
Yeah.
Mark Dayton?
I think it's a temporary political palliative. I think that this administration can fairly be faulted for being asleep at the energy policy switch. I would say that given that there's this legitimate concern for building our strategic reserve and our self-sufficiency, that it was a mistake for Congress in 1995 to change the law and allow the oil that's taken from Alaska through the Trans-Alaskan pipeline and sell it, allow the energy companies to sell it overseas rather than keep it here in the United States. So I think we need a more consistent policy. I think we need one that puts our own energy independence first and then deals with the massive dependence that we have in this country on foreign oil.
Another question here. Go ahead, James.
I just want to respond to that. I think early in the campaign you ran an ad, Mark, that made that point, and I looked at that ad and I said, that's crazy. I mean, we're talking about a world market. If we ship the oil from Alaska onto the world market, that's simply affecting the overall world market. We'll just import it from somewhere else. I don't see how that has affected the price in the least.
Well, if we're just saying that the dependence on foreign oil is a part of the problem, and I think it is, then to say that we're going to allow the oil that we explore and develop here in this country to be sold overseas, to me, undermines that policy. It ought to go into our own strategic oil reserve and be used for our energy self-sufficiency.
I think we're talking about net dependence. If we have the ability to export oil, you'd have to subtract that from our dependence upon imported oil and determining net dependence.
Rod Grams?
Our ability to produce it is the important thing, as Jim is saying, and we have to have that capacity. And this administration for a decade has cut off our ability to produce, explore, or do anything to make ourselves more energy independent. But what Mark is saying, it oversimplifies what really happened there when Congress decided to allow this oil to be sold on the market. It is because the refineries in California were tied to nothing but Alaskan oil. There was no competition. The prices were going up. And in order to make it a competitive level playing field, the decision was made to give it competition. So there was a lot more into it than just saying, well, we're going to ship our oil somewhere else. It did help in the world net market. And it did improve the price situation in California. And it did not affect one dime, one penny of gasoline prices here in the Midwest at all.
Just a quick yes or no answer. George W. Bush has suggested that as part of a longer-term way to deal with our energy problems, we should open up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska to drilling. Would you support that? Let's see. Who's first? Mark Dayton?
No.
Rod Grams?
Yes.
Nope. James Gibson? Question here from our audience asking, what are your thoughts on the new abortion pill? And let me change that just a tad. Same general subject area, though, and the Senate does vote to confirm Supreme Court nominees, and the question here is, should nominees' views on abortion play a role in their nomination? Rod Grams?
Well, everything that they've done you take into consideration when you're looking at whether or not to vote for or against a Supreme Court nominee. But I think the strongest endorsement has to come from whether this nominee will carry out and enforce the laws of the land and the Constitution of the United States. And that's what I look at each and every time that one of these nominees come before me.
James Gibson?
I think I would rather look at it from the standpoint of how a prospective justice thinks and reasons through issues rather than on their prior conclusions. And I think history has shown that their conclusions tend to change from prior periods because they haven't spent that amount of time thinking about it. So I think how they think is much more important than the specific positions they've taken.
Mark Dayton?
I would agree with Senator Grams that the overall qualifications are what should be taken in overriding concern. And what their positions on particular issues is also fair for consideration. I think on an issue like this where the Roe versus Wade decision is very likely hanging by one Supreme Court justice in the balance, that it would be an appropriate line of inquiry for the Senate to look into under for any nominee. But I think the overriding consideration should be overall qualifications.
Globalization, question kind of related to that. Do corporations have any responsibility to expand here, either in Minnesota or in the United States, rather than perhaps go overseas where costs are much lower and presumably they could make a lot more money? Who gets to go first? James Gibson, I guess you're first.
I don't see it as this or that because I think there is a relationship between exports and imports, and to suggest that if they expand overseas that's somehow hurting us here is not looking at the bigger picture. I view trade as mutually beneficial, and I don't think we need to restrict the flow of capital one way or the other. The one thing I will say that I think will improve our overall trade picture, and we should give this serious thought, this is seldom talked about in the public domain, and that's our overall level of national savings in this country, because what happens is the trade surplus, this is a little bit of a simplification, but it tends to be the flip side of an investment flow to the United States. And by changing the conditions that attract capital flowing in this direction, we can affect trade flow. So I favor strong national savings because it has the effect of pushing down interest rates and causing capital to tend to flow outward rather than inward. And one of the reasons I'm so opposed, by the way, right now to a tax cut, and this is a sort of a secondary consideration, but it has the effect of reducing our national savings at this point. What we have is government now is a net saver. And if you compare this back a few years when it was a negative saver to the tune of about 5% of GDP, we're now a positive saver, and it's offsetting the kinds of low savings rates we're seeing at the personal level. So very important national savings in this overall trade picture.
Mark Dayton?
I don't think corporations have that responsibility not to act in their own best financial interest and to, as long as they're conducting themselves responsibly in other countries, seek lowest wages and other input costs. I mean, that's the corporate structure. Well, that's why the government policy is so crucial, because the government policy has to then weigh in the balance that obvious strategy on the part of corporations versus how that's going to affect its citizens in the balance. And that's where I think this Clinton administration has fallen short. I was down in Winona a couple weeks ago. Winona knitting mills there, 360 employees a year ago, will have zero this fall. The entire company nationwide will have no active manufacture of fabrics, because they simply cannot compete at any price. So that's been totally offshore sourced. And not only with NAFTA, and the administration again in the last few months has grandfathered in all the Caribbean islands and Central American countries.
Mr. Dayton, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to interrupt because we're just about out of time here.
So we're putting in the wrong direction.
Rod Graham's a quick chance to comment on this too.
Well, I think talking to most businesses, they would love to expand here if they could, but you know, capital is going to find its own level, and if that means that, you know, the best way to provide goods and services around the world is to locate plants in different parts of the world, they'll do that. You know, we've had many foreign companies locate here because it must have been more attractive for them to move their business and operations here at the same time. So we've got to make sure that we have a business climate that is going to be attractive for people to be here to produce the jobs and the products that are going to help expand our economy. So I think that's a positive. And if Mark's talking about government policy to distort the free market, then you're going to distort it in a way that's not good for everybody.
Okay, 2 minutes to wrap up, 2 minute closing statements before we finish up here. And let's do this in kind of reverse order. Mark Dayton, you go first.
Last arrived, first to go.
the LIFO candidate.
Again, thank you very much for this opportunity. I think that we have missed some of our audience since there are high school students here, and so I'd like to close by focusing on education, because I think that's often given short shrift, and that is a big part of our future. You know, we in Minnesota, I think, have succumbed to what I call the big lie that we are putting all this extra money over the last decade into public education, and we haven't been receiving the desired results, when in fact, in real dollars, we're spending less per student than we did 10 years ago, and relative to the increasing needs of many of our students, we're spending far less than we did then and than we should today. And the federal government is part of that problem, particularly in the area of failing to fund special education, which was a promise the federal government made and when it passed the Disabilities Act in the 1970s, that it would provide 40% of the funding for the costs of states and local governments. Today it's only 9% in Minnesota, and that's one of the reasons that school boards all over the state are in a squeeze and having to divert money from other programs to make up that shortfall. I believe the federal government should be putting 40% of the costs of special education into next year's budget to keep its promise, and also to provide $250 million of additional funding that will go into schools throughout Minnesota, right into the classrooms, can be used not only to improve the quality of the programs for the kids with special needs, but expand the quality of our academic offerings to all of our students. That's where we need to make as much emphasis as we are when we're talking about some of these other issues that may legitimately be of concern to the business community, but we're leaving out the whole segments of our population. And that's why I propose we have one debate in every congressional district, and we go all over so we can talk about a whole range of subjects, and I would repeat that invitation today.
Democrat Mark Dayton. Independent candidate James Gibson.
Well, first of all, I want to thank the Chamber for hosting this event and NPR for broadcasting it. I hope to leave you today with a sense of the kind of concern I have for the future and how it's important for us as individuals and as society to make decisions that are responsible, mature, that have a long-term perspective. You all have kids, and if you'll have grandkids someday if you don't already, but the point is we need to look down the road, and that involves making some tough decisions today. If we spend everything we make, the world next year will be less desirable than the world this year, and so on and so on. If we're prudent, we make long-term investments, we set aside a portion of our national output, and that's what this talk about is about, what the surplus is all about. It's representative of, are we willing to take a portion of our national output and invest it back? When we pay down the debt, we're talking about returning that to the private market so that those investments are made. The question is, do we have the maturity to forego the tax cuts and the spending increases? And I hope to leave you with my concern for that. It comes very much viscerally. That is, I have a passion for these kinds of issues. I feel we inherited so much as a society. We're so lucky to be born in this country, and the opportunities here are so great. And I just feel that we need to honor that and commit to making those kinds of long-term decisions.
Independent Party candidate James Gibson, and finally Republican Rod Grams.
Thank you very much, Gary. And of course, thanks to NPR and also the North Metro Chamber for putting this event together to give us a chance to at least discuss some of the issues. And I think the issues here are very clearly defined between Mark Dayton and myself. It's either between big government and more government, or giving you more responsibilities and opportunities. And we can talk about it when we come to education. Mark always likes to talk in flowery terms and talk around the issue, but never gets to the heart of it. And once in a while, it bleeds through a little bit. But when he talks about better education, he wants to make sure it's the Washington bureaucrats that are going to make sure your kids get a better education. He wants Washington to put more money into what you do at the local level. Well, where the money comes the power and the strings attached, and his plan would sap away your ability as parents and teachers and school boards to have control over education. When we talk about tax cuts, he always says, well, we can invest in our future. The government has a better savings rate, or the government can do better. In other words, he's saying this tax surplus is better handled by Washington than allowing you to keep more of the hard-earned money that you make. We talk about Social Security. I am very concerned about Social Security. I've worked on it for nearly 8 years. I proposed a plan 3 years ago. I know this subject inside and out, even though maybe my opponents haven't read my plan and distort it. But my mother is here, my daughter is here, and my grandchildren. And it's those generations that we're concerned about, to make sure those on retirement today, our generation to retire tomorrow, and our kids and grandkids are going to have a good retirement system, not a meager government check. And when we talk about health care and medical prescriptions, let's not fall into the trap of having universal or national health care, Hillary care. And that's exactly where Mark Dayton would lead us if we allow this election to go the wrong direction. So I'm here today to thank you for your help and support, and ask for your help and support and your vote in November. Thank you.
Republican Rod Grams, and thanks to all of our candidates for participating today. Rod Grams, James Gibson, Mark Dayton. Good luck to all of you in the campaign. Thanks to all of you here at the Majestic Oaks.